This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Almost 20 years ago, the White River experienced a toxic discharge from an auto plant that wiped out over 4 million fish. Since then, the river has been on a long journey of restoration. What is the state of the river now? Today, we're taking a close look at the White River, and we'll take your questions and comments on social media. What role does the river play in your life? Do you use it for recreation? Are you unsure of how safe the untreated water is to interact with? Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. Joining me now are two reporters from the Indy Star who've been working on a series about the White River, investigative reporter Sarah Bowman. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
And data reporter Emily Hopkins. Welcome, Emily.
Thank you so much.
You've both spent months reporting on the White River, and you've released a series of pieces looking at the river from several different angles. Sarah, what sparked the interest to dive into this topic, if you'll pardon the phrase?
Right. Well, it was kind of a lot of things. Both Emily and I, neither one of us are from Indiana or Indianapolis. And so when we arrived here a couple of years ago as environmental reporters, obviously we saw this river that was running through our city. And, you know, but we kept hearing everyone say, don't touch it, don't go near it, you know, you'll turn green and glow and those sorts of things. And so we just kind of were... It was always something that was in the back of our heads, kind of what's the deal with this river? And so, you know, we just kind of have reported on a variety of things, but that was one we kind of kept coming back to and people kept also asking us about it. And so we finally figured it was time to, as you said, kind of take the plunge and figure out what was going on with the White River.
Let's find out about some of those questions. Emily, I understand that the river was a topic that people were often asking about. What were people asking? What interest or concerns were you hearing?
It was a lot about how dirty the river actually was. I think people had a conception that you shouldn't be swimming in it, but they weren't really sure, was this toxic waste from industry or was this some other kind of reason why you shouldn't touch it? And then on the other end of it, there were people who sort of would say that it's completely safe and I go, you know, wading it all the time and I'm not scared of it. And so we needed to kind of dig into the data and talk to some experts to really understand which one of those are true. And it turns out they are both kind of true in part.
Sarah, can you give us an idea of the amount of communities that the river impacts in Indiana? How much of the state does it run through?
Yeah, I mean, it's the White River is actually, it starts and ends in Indiana. So it's kind of Indiana's river a little bit, if you will. And it runs about 62 miles, I think. And it starts on the east side of the state, just north of Richmond, and it runs through quite a few of our bigger cities in Indiana. It runs through Muncie, runs through Anderson, obviously down through Hamilton County and here into Indianapolis and then south down and kind of connects to the Wabash just north of Evansville. But I mean, it is along the White River and within the White River watershed, it is a few million people that kind of live in this area and so are both impact and are impacted by the White River.
Emily, as you write in the piece, the river is, quote, alternately maligned and ignored, end quote. What do you mean by that?
Yes, absolutely. So I think you can see this a lot if you travel to other cities who have rivers and really celebrate their rivers. And one thing that's really remarkable about Indianapolis, you know, that's where I live now and I work downtown. But if I didn't do this job, I would never know how close we were to the river. It's consistently tree lined and hidden from areas where it flows next to. And you contrast to that to, you know, I used to live in Boston. You have the Charles River and it's so celebrated and visible and such a heart of the city. And then you see the way that Indianapolis even built its downtown with its back to the river. So I think that you see the ways in which we've tried to disassociate ourselves from the river. And, you know, one of those – I think that's one of the reasons it's so misunderstood. And because people don't interact with it, they assume that it's disgusting, polluted, because it's had that reputation from a time when you were legally required to discharge your industrial waste into the river, when we didn't have any kind of sewer system and waste just flowed into the river, so much so that farmers downstream actually sued the city of Indianapolis because their animals didn't want to drink the water. So it's been difficult to shake that reputation when people can't even see the river flow through the city.
Let's before we get into more details about the state of the river today, let's talk about the history of the river. We're approaching that 20-year anniversary of the toxic discharge that killed every fish from Anderson to Broad Ripple. That was a quote. Sarah, for those of us who are unfamiliar with the spill, what happened?
Yeah, and I will say that we are planning to have another story as part of the series come out on this later, so certainly stay tuned. But it was in December 1999, so 20 years ago this year, and it was the Guide Corporation, which made kind of headlights and different things for cars up in Anderson. And they're actually – they're facility is a couple miles off the banks of the White River, but they were really pushing to kind of try and meet some orders and that sort of thing. And they had a big discharge of chemicals, and it essentially made its way into their pipes and to the treatment facility. And it just – it was too much for the treatment facility to handle. And so it just ended up making its way directly into the White River. And the kind of, we know it killed about 4 to 5 million fish in the river, just about every single one from Anderson down into the Indianapolis area. And, you know, there are lots of that. And that was kind of one of the main things that actually really first sparked people taking notice of the river and kind of being like, hey, we have this, you know, beautiful natural resource here, and this is how we're treating it, and, you know, this is not okay. And so that kind of first got things going.
So this incident was kind of like our Cuyahoga fire. That's what happened in Cleveland, and this is what happened here.
Exactly. That is a – it's a really good comparison, that it was kind of one of those first things that really got the ball rolling.
Emily, the dirty history goes even further back. There was a point, as you said earlier, when industry was required by law to discharge their waste directly into the river, which included carcinogens and heavy metals. How far back does this history of pollution go?
Well, I think you really just have – you trace it back to the settlement of Indianapolis. Wherever people were, there was waste, and we didn't have the kinds of sewage systems and waste treatment systems that we have now. As the city grew, it got to be a bigger problem. We added a sewage system in the first half of the 20th century that sent the waste directly to the river. No pretense of treatment there. We built more sewers that were that combined sewage overflow. So maybe it traveled to a waste treatment plant, but then you have the rains that dump the sewage into the river even today. That's what the Dingany Project is trying to address, and you'll hear more about that later in this hour. And then, of course, with the development of industry, we figured out – we as Americans figured out how to make a lot of chemicals in the 20th century, and it took us some time to understand what those chemicals could do to the health of people who are exposed to them. If you deal with environmental issues – you'll probably hear the solution to pollution is dilution. Mm. And that's something that we've definitely heard here in Indiana, but mostly from environmental folks who are kind of, characterizing the attitude of some people in some industries historically and even now. And I think that's definitely how we treated the river as it was settled and as our population grew right up to, the Clean Water Act passage in the 70s.
Now let's bring the Clean Water Act into the picture. Sarah, what regulations does that impose, and how do those regulations impact the river?
Yeah, so, the Clean Water Act came about, and it really actually kind of, speaking of the fire on the Cuyahoga River, it kind of came about soon after that fire that, there was kind of a national recognition that, hey, we got to look at, what industry is doing to our waterways. And so the Clean Water Act really was meant to kind of target and address this industrial pollution, and worked to create permits, developed standards of, levels of chemicals and things that were allowed in the water, and worked to create these permits with industry of what they were allowed to put into the water, at trying to meet these standards that were deemed safe, and having to do work treat the chemicals or that sort of thing before discharging into the river. So it really worked to address some of those pollution problems. And it really did go a long way to helping to clean up a lot of waterways around the country. But there are a lot of aspects of things that pollute our rivers and you know, that have developed in some of the years since the Clean Water Act was established that really do a lot to pollute our rivers as well that are not as addressed in the Clean Water Act or falls a little bit short in some of those areas. And those are some of the things now that we're also really trying to work to address to keep these contaminants out of our waterways and out of the White River.
If we look at today, the city of Indianapolis and Hamilton County Tourism have partnered to present the White River Vision Plan. What does that plan entail?
Well, that plan looks at 58 miles of the White River in Hamilton and Marion counties, and it's kind of a plan to bring people back to the river, bring the communities and these residents back to the river, and it is looking at establishing more trails, connecting trails along the river to get people there, making it more accessible, establishing kind of some beaches areas along the river, a lot of restaurants and shopping and retail and those sorts of things, really just trying to get the community to come back to and engage with the river. There's still a lot of things that need to happen in order to, make this vision come about. Kind of the ideas are there, and now it's about bringing it into reality. And there's, I think, a lot of challenges that are still in the way to making that happen. But it's something that the community has really gotten behind because we have this river. Why we might as well enjoy it and use it.
Well, let's talk about a tangible effect of the effort that has gone into cleaning up this river. There is a lot of work still to be done, but you've highlighted a lot of signs of progress, one of which is the return of smallmouth bass. And you talked with some fishermen that were excited to have these fish back. Why is that significant?
When the – particularly 20 years ago when that fish kill happened and it wiped out every single species, it was a long road to getting those species back. And the fact that we have those today and they're healthy and they're not – they don't have lesions all over their skin, that makes people very excited from an environmental standpoint and a recreational standpoint.
Emily Hopkins, data reporter at the Indy Star, thank you so much for coming in. And Sarah Bowman, investigative reporter at the Indy Star, thank you. We hope you can stick around for the rest of the show. Up next, more about the research that's been done. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to the topic of the White River, I want to tell you about a show we did on Indiana authors yesterday, where we heard about the restructuring of literary awards in Indiana, as well as some tips to become a better writer yourself. You can find a podcast of that and all past shows wherever you get your podcasts. Today, we're talking about the White River, what contaminants are in that river, and what's being done to minimize further pollution. As always, we're taking your questions and comments on social media. If you have questions about how you can help protect the river, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. In the studio now, we welcome the director of the Center for Urban Health at IUPUI, Dr. Gabe Filippelli.
Thanks, Matt.
And also joining us is executive director of the White River Alliance, Jill Hoffman. Jill, thanks for being here today.
Nice to be here.
And, of course, we still have Indy Star reporters Sarah Bowman and Emily Hopkins. Dr. Filippelli, you and your team of researchers went down the White River. What was your goal and what data were you trying to collect?
So for the last year, as part of our Environmental Resilience Institute program at IU, we've been measuring water quality in some of the tributaries here in Indianapolis. And they've been notoriously bad in terms of things like E. coli and pathogens that have a very strong impact on human health. So our goal there was to see what is the baseline before we transform these tributaries with these big infrastructure projects. And as an important reference point, we decided to, in partnership with the STAR, to go up to one location on the White River just south of 16th Street and sample about three times a week really intensively for some of these pathogens to try to see, even if you clean up the tributaries, what does the White River already have in it as a potential hazard?
What'd you find?
We found the normal stuff, right? It has various chemicals at standard levels. But what shocked us most was that the levels of these pathogens, so E. coli, were extremely high all month long. The reason why we picked July was specifically because if you were going to come in contact with a river, it would be less likely to do it in January than in July.
Of course, yeah. Well, what are the health consequences of close contact with E. coli?
Well, there's two. One is ingestion of E. coli. You've heard of terrible cases of E. coli contamination and spinach and so forth. It comes from human and animal waste, effectively. And ingestion of it can make you very sick. Ingestion of a lot of it can make you that much sicker, and it can kill you, in fact. Mm. And then there's also, if you have open sores or wounds, it can cause skin infections.
So what does that mean for people that spend time by the river? Obviously, you probably shouldn't swim. But can you wade in the water, or should we be avoiding it altogether?
No, you certainly can wade in the water. If you have open sores, it might not be a good idea. Or if you do, you better put some antibacterial gel on it immediately and wash off immediately. But it's not at the level where you can just take a hop in and go for a swim.
Were you surprised at that level of E. coli and other contaminants?
You know, I was surprised because the tributaries we're looking at all come into the White River. You know, rivers are a product of the tributaries and direct input. All of these tributaries came in below, downstream of where we sampled. So we were sampling this area where it won't be affected by these big Indianapolis infrastructure projects. So we assumed that it would be better. Mm. But in fact, it was no better than some of our worst offenders.
Jill, these findings are interesting because they suggest that the White River already has a significant amount of contaminants once it reaches Indianapolis. What's contributing to this level of contaminants?
Yeah, that's a good question because I think that we forget that it's a reflection of 1.7 million acres of a variety of land uses. So there are a lot of sources that end up in there, from agriculture to, you know, backyard pollution to industry to just this general stormwater runoff that crosses the landscape. Lots of sources. It's a cocktail of sorts.
We talked with Sarah and Emily earlier about how the Clean Water Act allowed for pollutants to be tracked back to the source, and then the source would be fined for polluting. These sound like contaminants that you can't really easily track. What's tough about this?
Well, it's tough because of kind of the way that we manage our water systems. So they're aggregating in a pretty diffuse and widespread network of pipes and that nobody sees or thinks about. So that often sort of leaves them removed from your daily thought or management. So I'm talking about our storm drains and our streets, right? So there's a inlet in front of your home or in the parking lot where you park your car. And then that connects up to literally hundreds of those things that then come out in thousands of outfalls in the river. But tracking back where those sources came from is so diffuse because they're collecting from acres and acres of, you know, either concrete parking lots or streets. Or similarly, in our agricultural areas, they have a tile drain system under those ag fields to help drain the crops. And that tile drain system is also a diffuse network that then aggregates runoff from many farm fields, acres and acres, and comes out in outfalls in the stream. So it's really difficult to track back the worst offenders in a case when really it's just an aggregate compilation of everybody's runoff.
Unless it's something really specific like what happened 20 years ago.
Correct, yeah. Yes.
So what exactly are we finding? What are the contaminants that we're finding in this kind of runoff, the urban runoff and the like?
Yeah, well, I mean, when I said it's an assorted cocktail, it's about everything you can think of, right? So we have pesticides and fertilizers are pretty big offenders. We have pharmaceuticals from our own wastewater coming in, right? So that's a big one. Lots of different bacteria and viruses from waste products, be them human or cattle or all of those sources. So we see a lot of that coming in. We see gas and oil and grease compounds from parking lots or, you know, those kinds of car and manufacturing processes. So it's quite a mix.
Sarah and Emily, are the runoff regulations stringent in Indiana?
I mean, runoff regulations kind of anywhere aren't super stringent. And just kind of like for the reasons Jill was saying, it's so hard to identify a source.
Can't really point a finger.
Exactly. To kind of have something in place to say, okay, if you do this, or if this person does this, or this company does this, then we won't, you know, have this problem anymore. Because it's the couple drops that when you're filling up your car at a gas station, you know, and you're taking the pump from your car to putting it back, you know, it drops a couple things. But if everyone that happens, you know, everyone who comes to that gas station, and then that's one gas station of dozens, you know, in a couple square mile radius, it accumulates. And so it's so hard to have these regulations in place to try and address stopping the pollution. What, you know, is kind of the way that we're realizing now and have realized for several years now, but kind of trying to put in place, is just stopping the stormwater from getting to the system, and doing that through things that are called green infrastructure. So allowing, not having so much impervious surface like our concrete, our parking lots, our roofs, all of these things, but trying to have more green to allow the water to soak into the ground and naturally filter through kind of where it lands, instead of collecting all of this stuff into this cocktail, as Jill called it, and then eventually going into our river.
Let's go back to the impervious surfaces. There's an example of an initiative that made people think about their contribution to runoff, and that's the stormwater fee structure that was implemented in 2015. That changed property owners, which charged rather property owners based on the amount of impervious surfaces that they owned. You kind of mentioned what qualifies as an impervious surface, but maybe break that down a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, so an impervious surface is really just something that you know, does not allow anything to go through it. So I mean, that obviously are your streets and your parking lots. It's something like your roof. I mean, so for this fee structure, it driveways and sidewalks. I mean, it's anything that really just kind of doesn't allow water or something like that to soak through it. And so for this fee structure, when they changed it, they charged homeowners based on the amount of impervious property that they had, you know, on their the amount of acreage or land that they owned, and then we'll charge them based on that. And it's a structure that that fee will increase incrementally every year. And then of course they're trying to offer incentives of, if you do things like put in a rain garden or things like that, that it will kind of give you some leeway with that and take some of those charges off, to try and really encourage people to try and have more pervious, less impervious, to more green, to allow it to soak through.
You mentioned homeowners. Are they most impacted by this charge, or are we talking industry as well?
Definitely industry and business as well. And especially industry and business are often ones that have, you know, the bigger parking lots and the bigger amounts of pavement and concrete. So they're very impacted by this as well.
Where does the money go from these fees?
Yeah, it goes to the Department of Public Works and a lot of their projects that they're doing about stormwater. So before this fee change, their budget was pretty small, just a couple million a year. And that was not at all the funding that they needed to do a lot of projects to try and upgrade the stormwater system and, you know, try and upgrade the pipes and those sorts of things. And so they had a pretty big backlog of projects, where areas around the city where, I'm sure you know, anytime we get a big rainstorm, you can drive and, you know, you'll have these flooded street corners and those sorts of things. And so now that money goes to them, and they're trying to work through that backlog to get to some of those projects.
Jill, where does the average citizen fit into this picture? Like, what can they do to help mitigate harmful substances getting into runoff?
Yeah, I think the key is really just everybody understanding that we have to individually have a role in this solution. Because as Sarah was talking about that stormwater money, what was running through my head is that even if we had all the money maybe in the world, it would be really hard to mitigate the scale of what's coming into our streams and lakes and all of those places. So we need to stop pollution at the source, because figuring out an engineering solution after it's aggregated to a level that's hard to deal with and in a volume that's hard to deal with, we could not retrofit, you know, 10,000 stormwater outfalls in these two counties where the Vision Plan is interested in working. So that means that the homeowner needs to, and the business owner for that matter, just ask yourself, where's the water on my property going and what can I do to keep it here and get it back in the ground? So, you know, we're really asking people to do a couple things. Think about how you can infiltrate water, whether that's rain gardens or directing your downspouts to places that don't run to a drain, but also reducing the pollution load that comes in. So really less or no lawn fertilizer, and cleaning up after your pets are simple kinds of things, but really native landscaping, less turf is key. I mean, to be honest, turf works a lot like an impervious surface. So there's a 2-inch root zone. It's doing nothing to push water back into the ground. So to the extent that you can look at your backyard and say, where do I need turf because I want my kids to kick the soccer ball around? Keep it. Where else can I plant native plant communities that really help infiltrate water, trap pollution, and just generally make a more sustainable urban landscape?
Dr. Filippelli, research from the Indiana Climate Change Impact Assessments out of Purdue University suggests that the state will see about 6 to 8% more annual rain by mid-century. And in the winter and spring, the increase could be considerably higher than that, as high as 27%. How would an increase like this impact our rivers and runoff systems?
Well, in fact, it's already increased over the last 30 years. The intense precipitation events have increased, and by all projections, and that's part of climate change, by all projections, it's going to continue to do so. Unless we do exactly what we've been hearing about today, which is make – in China, it's a concept called the Sponge City Initiative. So they're trying to make cities back into sponges of intense rainfall to minimize the amount of water that our storm systems have to handle. But right now, frankly, with these the projected extreme precipitation events, it's going to be really challenging to clean up a lot of these rivers because the CSOs, these combined sewer outflows, will still have the capacity, and actually will need to activate it at extreme events, and that's when you get E. coli in the water systems.
Mm. Jill, you were part of the leadership that put together the second annual Indiana Water Summit this year. Was addressing stormwater and the potential increase we could see something that was discussed?
Yeah, in fact, so the summit is designed to be that place where we can have a holistic water management discussion, right? We cannot disconnect our agricultural leaders from our urban leaders. And so we need a place to convene and to share ideas and to collaborate. So that's what it's all about. But yeah, the afternoon, to answer your question, we had a whole segment on climate and stormwater. We also had a whole panel on agriculture because the management of their water is integral to this whole system as well. So collapsing these conversations outside of the silos of the kinds of industry or the lifestyles that we all live is absolutely essential to moving the needle. I mean, this is a shared resource, and everybody needs to be pulling in the same direction.
Who showed up? Who came to the Water Summit?
Well, we had a legislative panel, and we've seen increased involvement from our legislature, so that's a big one. But mayors, city planners, leading farmers in sustainability, many of our agencies, reporters, interested citizens, honestly, that are, you know, running their homeowners association or their lake association, dealing with the impacts of this kind of thing, utility operators. So that's our goal, as diverse as possible. The summit's for everyone. The conversation is one that every citizen needs to be engaged in, whether you're a professional in the water world or you're just a business owner or you're just a homeowner. It's all our sort of livelihood depends on this conversation.
And the river is, of course, ultimately a source of drinking water for many in Indiana, and that deserves protecting. But the river offers a lot more than just utility. Can you talk about the different kinds of value that the river brings to people?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, where do you start? Every time you know, take a drink of water, make a cup of coffee, get in the shower. Here, our surface water source is our primary source of drinking water, which shows up in your tap. So it's important to think about from that everyday value. But our industries, our utilities are electric. Every time you turn the lights on, you're using water. People don't think about that. Every time you go to your job at a place like Eli Lilly or National Starch or some of these places that are major water users, your economic vitality becomes dependent on a water supply that industry can count on. So, and then, of course, you can't negate sort of the recreational aspect of it and sort of the respite that it allows people in an urban environment to use and to kind of escape some of the stresses of an everyday life. So a lot of people retreat to the water for that, and that's an important value.
I have an interesting question here from Judy, and I'm not sure who would take this, and I don't even know if we have this data, but do we know if the Anderson spill was responsible for an increase in birth defects at that time? Does anyone have that data?
I don't have a specific answer, but from what I understand, the the chemical itself actually broke down in as it flowed down the river. And so I don't know, and I don't have the firm answer on this, but I don't know that it actually got into the drinking water. And I don't think that it if someone would have been exposed long enough just based on what I know about public health.
Jill, do you feel confident that meaningful progress can be made with respect to this?
Yes, I always say that, you know, everybody needs a good crisis to have the right set of solutions come out. But I think, you know, as Gabe was talking about, climate's going to give us that crisis, whether we want it or not. So I think we're ready. I think we need to be ready. And I think that we have a lot of smart people in this community that are willing to, you know, kind of get out of those silos and have a conversation and just get us more prepared. I think, you know, seeing how many people showed up to comment on the vision plan, seeing the participation in the Water Summit. We have this Clear Choices Clean Water Pledge campaign. Seeing thousands of people pledge action about what they can do around their home is inspiring to me.
She's the executive director of the White River Alliance. Jill Hoffman, thank you so much for talking with us. And he's the director of the Center for Urban Health at IUPUI, Dr. Gabe Filippelli. Thanks for being here.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
Up next, we'll hear more about how water running through the river becomes water running through your faucet from Citizens Energy Group. Water quality manager Dan Moran and manager of communications Dan Considine will join us next to talk about the process of cleaning and filtering water for daily use. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in a minute and a half. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on the White River. We're back again with Sarah Bowman and Emily Hopkins of the Indy Star. And we're also joined now by the water quality manager at Citizens Energy Group, Dan Moran. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And also in the studio today is Citizens Energy Group's manager of communications, Dan Considine. Dan, you thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Dan Moran, water quality manager at Citizens Energy Group. Your chief responsibilities are to filter and decontaminate the water from the river so that when we turn on our faucets in the morning, we can have clean and safe drinking water. We'll get into how you achieve that, but saying that out loud, I recognize that's no small responsibility. Is the weight of this job something that you and your coworkers feel every day?
It certainly is. There's a And the weight really is spread across a large group of folks at Citizens. Having water quality in my title is a little bit of a misnomer because so many people at working for the water utility all have water quality at the top of their priority and actually treating the water and then actually operating the water treatment plant. So it's a shared burden, but everybody that works there realizes that we are producing a product that our friends and families are consuming, and they take that very seriously every day.
The water has to meet EPA standards after treatment. That's mandatory. What do those standards look like?
Oh, gosh, that's a long question because there are a lot of different requirements and regulatory requirements for the finished drinking water. And the most simple way I like to kind of describe it is three primary areas of treating the water in that, you know, the water in the river has solids and basically dirt in it that makes it look brown. And so one of the parts of the process are designed to remove all those solids from the water, make it a clear product. One of the issues with the water that we're treating is also a second one is that there are microorganisms in there. And you've talked about that on your show as well. So we also have processes that are specifically targeted to make sure and remove or eliminate or kill any of those microorganisms. And there are multiple barriers of protection on that side of things. And then the third area is just all sorts of different organic compounds or things that could be in the water. I think that there are pesticides and things like that mentioned earlier. And there's monitoring and processes to also address those types of contaminants. So those are kind of the three big buckets.
There are also non-enforceable health goals for drinking water. Can you explain the difference between what the mandatory standards are and what a non-enforceable health goal is?
So all of our formal compliance requirements are based on those mandatory requirements that the EPA has put out. And those are the items that have had a lot of scientific scrutiny and have been determined to be possibly present in water supplies and are therefore required treatment for to have the water considered to be safe and potable. But more recently, in the last few years, different items have come up that have been a concern, and different guidance documents that are technically they're not enforceable to the utility, but they're still recommendations that if they're present, that the public be notified and public communications about those things be provided to the public. So we have specific monitoring programs for some of those non-enforceable standards. And when we say enforceable, it just means that it's not technically in our a regulatory compliance framework, but it is still monitored and taken very seriously from the utility perspective and from the public health protection standpoint.
Let's talk about how you make the magic happen, so to speak. How do you convert water with concerning levels of E. coli in some areas to water that we can use in daily life?
Well, you know, one of the core assumptions in treating surface water by how the treatment plant operates, how the licensed operator is managing the plant, is the basic assumption that there are things in the raw water that are bad. So any even short breakdown of the process would be a major issue. So we're reliant on the process being monitored and working correctly 100% of the time. So the core assumption is that in that raw water, there are things that you don't want in your finished drinking water, and we have our risk management plan set up to make sure that those are again treated 100% of the time. There's no breakdowns, and we have actions plans in place for shouldn't there be various issues come up that are unexpected.
According to Citizens 2018 Drinking Water Report, our tap water met federal mandates. Sarah, can you talk a little bit about concerns around whether or not federal mandates are adequate enough in regards to contaminants in the water?
Yeah, and I'm sure Emily could also jump in on this as well. But a lot of folks sometimes have the concern that just kind of as you said, that there are a lot of standards and limits that are there for certain chemicals and those sorts of things. But, some of those may have been set years back. And so there could be some updated science and research on them that suggests that they should be lower. And some of them are just, goals and things to kind of keep an eye out for. But as Dan mentioned, that it's not necessarily something that there could be enforcement action on if, the final water was actually over that limit that was out there. And obviously there are quite a few utilities out there like Citizens that really do take those goals very seriously and do the work that they can to make sure that they are under that. But without it being an actual enforceable, standard and limit, I know there's a lot of questions out there that are there things that are making it into our final drinking water that necessarily shouldn't be. But it's hard to put in place the processes or the equipment or the things needed to treat it and get it to that level if it's not a requirement, if it's not a regulation, because that cost ultimately would get passed on to ratepayers. So, putting that in place without saying, well, this is a regulation that I am required to meet is, a difficult dance. And so that's where a lot of environmental groups and some folks think, if we just had the standards a bit lower, that would for certain chemicals and those sorts of things would, be a bit stronger.
Of course, the fewer contaminants that actually reach the treatment plant to begin with, the better. Dan Considine, Dig Indy, is a massive infrastructure initiative that's been underway for some time now. Sure. For those of us unfamiliar with the project, what's the goal here?
Sure. So Dig Indy represents the largest infrastructure project in the city's history. And, I describe it as a generational project. What does that mean? It can help transform the rivers and streams here in Marion County. So what we're building a 28-mile network of deep tunnels, 250 feet below Marion County. They're 18-foot diameter tunnels, not too different than a subway tunnel. And as you've described earlier, we have a combined sewer system here in Indianapolis, meaning we have stormwater and sanitary sewage from homes and businesses in the same system. That system was designed to overflow into our rivers and streams. By 2025, Dig Indy will eliminate up to 99% of the sewer overflows that are currently happening in Marion County. Just since 2017, December of 2017, December 29th, as a matter of fact, the first 10 miles of that 28 miles opened. And over that period, so all of 2018 and here three quarters of the way through 2019, that first 10 miles has captured about 1.3 billion gallons of sewage.
Wow.
That would have gone into the White River and Eagle Creek in southern Marion County. So it is a transformational, a generational investment. When I say generational investment, in my lifetime, I've seen the building of the interstate highway system. Now, that's a nationwide system, but that really had a transformational effect on our economy in the United States and every community. You think about 465 here and the interstates that came through here. This kind of project has the, you know, is going to help transform our rivers and streams. Does it mean that the streams will be pristine afterwards? No, it does not. But it's going to have an enormous impact on the quality of the water that's in the river as well as the aquatic life that survives in the river. So it's really, I mean, there's a great sense of excitement among the people that work at Citizens on this project because they know that this is going to have a huge impact on our community. You know, rivers and streams, that the thing about Indianapolis is our rivers and streams run through neighborhoods. I think it was Emily or I can't recall if it was Emily or Sarah. They talked about how the river here is kind of hidden. It really is. Mm-hmm. But the tributaries of the river are really not. People see the Pleasant Run and Pogue's Run and Fall Creek. They literally run right through neighborhoods. So the people that live near those streams, they know they're polluted because they can smell those streams. Mm. And that problem is going to be, like I said, it's not going to be completely eliminated. There are other impacts to the streams upstream of the sewer system, but this is going to have an enormous impact. And we know that in part by looking at other cities that are further ahead than we are. Chicago, for example, Milwaukee, where tunnel systems were built in the 1990s. So they're starting to see those great impacts on their rivers and streams.
You mentioned that the first 10 miles are done. I'm sure that more has been done.
Right. So I can talk real quickly about the schedule, where we're at.
Sure.
What a lot of people don't know is that as we complete this tunnel system, we're opening it. So the first 10 miles opened in late 2017, and then we have several more sections of Dig Indy that will be done between now and 2025 when the whole system is complete. I think the next leg to come online is the White River Fall Creek Tunnel System. That's a very large portion of the 28 miles. That'll be coming online, I think, late 2021. So as each section gets completed, we will open that section and the benefits will start flowing to that part of the river or tributary.
Sarah, another idea floated throughout your work is green infrastructure. Can you talk about what that is and how it would help?
Yeah, so green infrastructure is something that really just allows as much of the water to soak in where it lands as opposed to, you know, hitting these impervious surfaces and running off and overloading, whether it's our stormwater system or the combined system. And you might not think, but stormwater is what makes such a big difference, and rainfall events are what makes such a big difference actually in the combined sewer overflows, because it's when we get about, you know, a quarter inch of rain or more that all of a sudden we could start having problems with our with this combined sewage overflowing into the river. And even with the Dig Indy Tunnel going into place, I know that there are a lot of projects, some of which Citizens are doing, you know, to plant
trees and those sorts of things to really try and help this water soak into and infiltrate into the ground, as opposed to going into the system, because even that will help with the dig indie tunnel, because if not as much water is going into the system, then it's not going to be overwhelmed and overloaded, and then you won't have as much problem with either it going into the tunnel, which it's still being collected, that's great, but if you can just prevent these things altogether. So some other examples of green infrastructure are things like pervious pavement, you know, just having pavement out there that actually allows it to kind of soak through a little bit, or having a rain garden on your property, or a rain barrel, which just helps to capture the rain coming off of your roof, or things like that, having these bioretention ponds. And some of it can also just be these wetlands and areas that we have around the river and our tributaries, really just protecting and preserving them, and not developing them, not putting in more green infrastructure. But it needs to be a very conscious thing, whether that's through incentives or even having some local ordinances and those sorts of things to really kind of push green infrastructure in any new development that's happening, or any rehab that's, you know, happening on current or older development.
Dan Considine.
Just to piggyback off what you said. So back in 2016, we started an initiative with Keep Indianapolis Beautiful called 10,000 Trees Initiative. And the idea there is to plant 10,000 trees in the combined sewer area of the city. And, you know, the benefits are just as Sarah described. And, you know, our engineers have calculated that during a rain event, when those trees are mature, and we're not putting in trees, you know, tiny little trees, we're putting in pretty good sized trees. But when those trees are mature, those trees will be able to absorb 1 million gallons of stormwater during a single overflow, what otherwise would be an overflow event. Mm. And it's not just the benefit of that, but trees benefit communities in so many ways. I mean, crime is lower, air quality is better. So we really see the green infrastructure as a real win for everybody. We're also using rain gardens and what they call bioswales in areas.
I want to make sure we get to this question from Hillary on Twitter. She said, we moved here from out of state and we're surprised to see that the city's Department of Public Works mows the riparian zones, the area bordering the body of water, along the White River and Indy's five parkways. This must be for aesthetics because it removes natural green infrastructure that we already have in place. Can the panelists comment on this phenomenon?
I think, I mean, just in general, part of green infrastructure, this was kind of one of the things that's so tricky about this as a whole, is it really does take just such a cultural shift and a mind shift. And Jill was talking about this a little bit too, just understanding that every single person has a role to play. And one of those things can just be our idea of what makes a beautiful lawn, because like Jill was saying, you know, just kind of having turf or just grass doesn't actually do that much to soak in. But if you have a lot of native plants and those sorts of things, that does so much more to kind of help the water infiltrate. And so, you know, not thinking of a pristine, crisp cut lawn as what's beautiful, but actually allowing kind of a bit more of nature to come in and just having these plants growing as they would really can help. But it does take that full culture shift of recognizing that as beautiful and not being like, oh, why is this so overgrown? Why aren't they taking care of, you know, the land or the property?
Dan Moran, really quickly, and I just wanted to ask this. Do you yourself have a water filtration system at your house?
Actually, I do have a water softener.
Which kind of acts as the same thing, yeah, but it does other things.
In Indianapolis, one of the aspects of living in central Indiana is that the natural water sources, we have a lot of limestone around here, and it's naturally hard waters, and that's just one of the things we deal with.
He's the water quality manager at Citizens Energy Group. Dan Moran, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Dan Considine, manager of communications with Citizens Energy Group, thank you for your time. Thanks. And from the Indy Star, Sarah Bowman, thanks.
Happy
Emily,
to be here.
Emily Hopkins, thank you.
Thank you so much.
I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In.